Hello, lovely digital listeners. Introducing Schools to Prisons, a collaborative research project between Our American Generation and the League of Education Voters. This project is about highlighting the concerning link between our nation's prisons and public education systems, a link that turns struggling students into juvenile delinquents.
Between us, we have two nonprofits. One, a youth-driven social justice think tank. The other, a statewide advocacy organization aimed at fixing Washington's public schools. Together, these groups are exploring the role of race and wealth in our public school system and how different demographics usually end up with different outcomes. Did you know that black male students are 3 times as likely to be suspended than white male students? Why do Latino students consistently perform worse on standardized tests when we know they are just as smart? These are some of the questions this series hopes to answer.
So we began this project in hopes of building off of OAG's Crime and Community zine. We started simply by looking at the data we already knew existed. There's research out there on what many refer to as the achievement gap. In a nutshell, since No Child Left Behind was passed in 2002, schools nationwide have been required to release their test scores and graduation rates broken down by race and economic status. Now that this data is required, we have a very powerful tool for measuring public school success rates by race and by income. So when folks in the U.S. started to observe all this new data, a disturbing trend was revealed, one that many already knew from experience. Our country's public school system is serving students of color and low-income students worse than white or higher-income students.
It's important to note that many studying this topic refer to it as the achievement gap. But for the purpose of our research here, we're referring to it as an opportunity gap for several reasons. Mainly, we aim to move away from a discussion that is focused on an individual student's achievement on a test or a grade, and more towards a discussion that looks at how our schools systematically deny students opportunities for success. This redefinition also helps remind us that there are large social implications for disparities in educational attainment. It's not just a matter of missed income for an individual that doesn't graduate from high school. It's the general welfare and prosperity of our entire nation that suffers.
Welcome to this segment of the League of Education Voters and Our American Generation's Schools to Prison series. The last segment explored the economic, social, and cultural cost of educational inequity. This time, we'll be looking more closely at the connection between a broken prison and education system and how ultimately they work together to disenfranchise youth with a very real and lasting effect on their lives.
How exactly do we push kids out of the schools and into a path towards jail? What does that process look like? In this podcast, we'd like to paint a picture of exactly how this broken system is changing kids from being pupils to being prisoners. Getting our cue from Michelle Alexander's recent work, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, we'll be looking at how these two systems, education and prison, perpetuate the very same inequities seen in America's Jim Crow era.
Students experience Jim Crow in the classroom and in the streets, through the guise of zero-tolerance policies and juvenile justice. But what does it actually mean for society when huge numbers of the population are imprisoned instead of educated? In what ways do the prison system and the public school system mirror the intention and actuality of Jim Crow politics? Have we really progressed?
We'll attempt to answer some of these questions as well as explore some solutions.
Before we dive in, let's refresh ourselves about the history and legacy of the Jim Crow era. In some ways, we've progressed as a society, but in what ways have we stayed the same? What does progress really mean when the inequalities of Jim Crow are repeated in the 21st century? These days, it's common to hear the term post-racial thrown around in political discourse when describing contemporary society. But let's unpack that phrase a bit more. Post-racial is the notion that our society has moved beyond race, as in we no longer hold biases towards others because of the color of another person's skin.
It is the notion that we don't need to acknowledge racial differences because there's a belief that we're all treated the same under fair and just laws. Opportunity gap data and jail sentencing data prove this plain untrue. Race matters. Race is real, and systems and people, whether consciously or not, perpetuate racial inequalities.
Granted, we're not living in an era such as Jim Crow, where the racism was explicitly spelled out in written policy and law. The U.S. doesn't have an explicit racial caste system anymore, but Jim Crow was more than just a set of laws. It was a way of life. It created a society in which people of color in the United States were relegated to the status of second-class citizens. Michelle Alexander argues that Jim Crow never ended, but that jails and prisons, because of disproportionate sentencing, are the current extension of Jim Crow laws. We'll outline in this podcast how some of the public school discipline data mirrors this trend. We're seeing a trend in which our nation's public schools are contributing to the mass disenfranchisement of people of color.
We'd like to illustrate how exactly this takes place by painting a picture of the school-to-prison pipeline, specifically focused on how high-stakes tests and zero-tolerance policies create hostile classrooms. We hope to show the ways in which policies, both inside and outside of the classroom, perpetuate this pipeline and work to disenfranchise students for the rest of their lives. We chose to focus on race and gender in this illustration in order to highlight the ways in which non-white male students are targeted by the public school system.
For the purposes of this podcast, we choose to focus on high school because evidence suggests that high school is a turning point in an adolescent's life. Which way they turn is to be determined. We realize that a system as big as public education is complex and is affected by both inside and outside factors.
While we know the education system is complex, we also think it's the most important place to start. The last podcast outlined the serious consequences for not getting a diploma, and we know that there are young people dropping out of high school as we speak.
Classroom culture, curriculum, teacher-to-student relationship, classroom management, and engagement of students are just a few of the factors that contribute to a young person's experience at school. As we've discussed in earlier podcasts, the range of quality in schools varies from city to city, county to county, and state to state. Much of what is being taught in the public school classrooms is based on preparing students to take a state standardized test, a test that will determine whether or not youth will graduate. That's a lot of pressure for a young person.
When we talked with students and teachers alike, they told us how important an inclusive curriculum and diverse learning materials are. However, the biggest factor the teachers we spoke with feel they are limited in what they can cover in class if it does not directly prepare a student for the material covered on a standardized test. A curriculum that does not relate to the lives of students, as well as the intimidation attached to failing a standardized test, creates a classroom culture in which kids are less than enthusiastic about the subject and scared they will fail.
Everybody has a part to play in the way we use standardized tests. They're helpful in the sense that they help measure what students are learning and whether or not they're learning the same thing in different schools, as well as assisting teachers in seeing what areas they need to work on. But there's a tendency for districts, principals, and teachers to penalize themselves for not performing well on standardized tests. This type of all-or-nothing method of testing students can create a hostile school culture, one that's based on a dichotomy of pass or fail, which is what creates the stress. Schools could become a sort of prison for students and for teachers in some way. We talked with Dr. Wayne Au, educator and activist, who gave us his insight on the issue of testing.
So in the past, standardized tests used to be given and they were used for informational purposes. They would look at the scores and say, okay, well, your students might be, they're a little below the national average in this or that. Let's look at how to improve that. Now, when you make it high stakes, you attach consequences to those results. Mm-hmm. So that's how you distinguish between just a regular standardized test and a high stakes test. So now they'll say, okay, in some cases, if you don't do well enough, then you're going to lose money. Or for a high school student, if you don't pass this test, you're going to not graduate, right? Or you're going to not make it to the next grade. Or for a teacher, if your students don't do well enough on these tests, then you're going to lose your job, right? That's been one of the latest things that's come up recently in national debate is tying teacher assessment to test scores. So what this does now, there's a couple different things to say about this. One is that just so I can put this up front, using these kinds of tests, high stakes standardized tests, they're actually really inaccurate. Our public image is that you get this solid number, it looks simple, and it's like, oh, this is clear, right? This student scored 80 on this test. We know that they did this, and next year they scored 85, so they improved. The problem is that they are actually pretty sloppy measurements. Like, you could have the same student take the same test on two different days and actually see sometimes 17, 20, 25% shift in score. Partly because maybe a student's emotional state on any from day to day could be different, and that impacts the test, how they do on the test. Partly because maybe they ate breakfast one day and didn't eat breakfast the next day, and that impacts how they do on the test. Maybe the kids they took the test with in the class, some of them are acting up one day and not acting up. That, so you see all these things actually get compounded and create like these wild fluctuations. How this would all relate to thinking about what this means in terms of classroom atmosphere, how it even relates to the kind of culture of learning in schools that we have, that it builds to, is that it creates literally a culture of fear in education. So you have kids taking tests and they're scared, like coming into the space, they're scared of failing, they're scared of the consequences. We know very clearly from both like just common sense and also research that fear actually inhibits learning. You know, and so we've developed this culture of fear based on an education policy like high stakes testing and how we've thought about accountability up to now in public education. And so we're asking teachers to teach while scared and students to learn while scared. I mean, like, it to me, it's crazy. It's not a healthy, it's not a nurturing human environment. And that's not, I mean, there are forms of assessment that we can demonstrate student learning that actually are about self-reflection and growth and sort of thinking about how you relate to the community and the world. Like, we can have that kind of assessment, but it just doesn't exist. Instead, we have sort of this opposite assessment that asks kids to sort of shrink into themselves and not really be in the world,
Some teachers feel the culture of urban classrooms have come to resemble an assembly line model of education that emphasizes conformity and creates a culture of fear for both the teacher and the student. Among the teachers we spoke with, many agree that there are some things students should all learn, like reading well by the third grade, writing, and basic math skills. That type of conformity makes perfect sense. However, the older students get, and the more their learning styles and interests differ, it gets increasingly hard to determine what should be taught or learned in school.